The Brendan O'Connor Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Care and protection for the whole family's health at All Care, taking care of communities across Ireland.
Dermot Whelan, good morning.
Good morning to you, Brendan. How are you?
I'm good. Now, Dermot, you're going to calm us all down now. People will know you, of course, as a broadcaster, as a comedian. They know you from Republic of Telly and Today FM. But what people might not know is that you are also, I won't say somewhat of a guru, but you're a meditation teacher, at least. I suppose,
definitely
Dermot,
not a guru.
you don't have the right accent for a guru anyway. Dermot, you came to meditation, I suppose, as a lot of people do, because something wasn't quite right. And you had huge success with the radio. You started doing comedy, that was going really well. But I get a sense of a fast-paced, slightly kind of frantic, out-of-control life. And you ended up then literally on the side of the road.
Yeah, I had a panic attack back in 2007. And as you say, I was very busy. I was doing breakfast radio, which had me up at 4:30 in the morning. I was doing comedy clubs at night, which got me into bed after midnight. I had small babies. I was doing bits of telly. And I suppose it was just like a perfect storm of busyness and an extreme lack of stress management skills, to deal with the stuff that I was doing. So I was driving down to Kilkenny to the Cat Laughs Comedy Festival, and I was relatively new to stand-up. So it was, it was a big deal for me. So I would have been nervous about that anyway. And I remember feeling like it was as if, the best way I can describe it, is as if the invisible man just got into the car and sat down on top of me while I was driving. So I felt this enormous pressure on my stomach and then up into my chest. And I was kind of, feeling a bit strange. And my brother-in-law was in the car with me at the time. And I was like, I don't think I feel very well. I think I'd have to pull over the car. And then it just seemed to get worse and worse. And I suppose what I didn't know what was happening is that I was having an anxiety attack. But I thought at the time that I was having a heart attack or a stroke or, that I was
about to check out. Yeah, which presumably adds to the anxiety.
Exactly. And so it's like this sort of, perpetual motion then, in terms of you're so worried about what's happening to you, you're exacerbating the situation. And when you get really bad, because you're hyperventilating from panicking, your carbon dioxide and oxygen levels get all out of whack. So then my
Dermot, I'm going to interrupt you there one second. You keep dropping out, and I think it's quite annoying if we want to have a proper conversation. So let's just see if we can get you back up on another line. In the meantime, the intergenerational strife continues here on our text line. And look, this was bound to come up again. It came up when they told us, whenever it was 4 weeks ago, that age is now the big determinant and age is how the vaccine should be rolled out. We'd frontline workers, SNAs, teachers, etc., giving out. And obviously they're back in texting today. What about frontline workers, SNAs, teachers, guards, retail staff, etc., in the 30 to 60 age group, says one texter. Then again, Onion Mayo says, I'm a 50-year-old. Happy to wait for vaccine after 18 to 30 year olds, so long as I can work from home until I am vaccinated. And there's a 33 year old here. My wife had a baby in May. She was on her own in hospital. We've been on our own all year. We haven't seen our parents all year. We've put our lives on hold to protect them and others. We've obeyed the rules. We're tired of the goalposts being moved. Never mind the fact that I'm a teacher and that's been moved again. So look, there's strong feelings around that. Dermot Whelan, are you back?
I am. Thankfully, I'm a meditation teacher, so I'm able to handle these stressful moments.
Okay. So when we left you, there was an invisible man sitting on you and you thought you were having a heart attack. You're on the side of the road at this stage, are you?
Yes, I was lying in the driveway of a bungalow, which I remember had pebble dash walls, and it had those eagles on the pillar that a lot of Irish houses have. I don't know, I suppose it's possibly known as having notions. But I remember feeling that that this was it, that I was checking out and I was going to be, this was my end. I was going to die, very near a roundabout in Mullinavat. This wasn't quite the stylish death that maybe I would have been hoping for.
And listen, the thing is, there were a few kind of, wake-up calls that I guess you weren't entirely always hearing. And not to make this about drink as well, but you were drinking your way along this to a certain extent as well. And you had another wake-up call. I think we've all had a wake-up call of some kind in a karaoke bar, but you had an extreme enough one.
One night, I suppose it was probably a couple of years after the Kilkenny incident, I was out and I obviously had a few, and I fell down the steps of a karaoke club and managed to knock myself out on the wall at the bottom of the steps and shove a champagne glass into my forehead. So when I woke up, I was covered in blood, and all I could hear was a hen party next to me singing "It's Raining Men." That was an extreme wake-up call. And, I don't think I was drinking any more than anybody else. But I suppose, like most people, you know, when we grow up, particularly in Ireland, the only really stress management skill we see demonstrated to us by the grown-ups around us is alcohol or nicotine or that kind of thing. So I suppose that's all I knew.
Yeah. And you see, the thing is, I presume that you were hiding all this stress very well, because, you know, people think, OK, a guy who does radio, a guy who can stand up in front of a full auditorium, do comedy and everything, they would imagine, OK, this guy is clearly full of confidence. But you kind of weren't, were you? You're quite a self-critical individual at this point as well.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people are, you know, a lot of people can be hypercritical, but it doesn't mean that they're not going to be sort of high achievers or put themselves in positions where, you know, they could be under pressure. So even though I was doing all these things, you know, I've certainly met a lot of comedians who, you know, have issues or who get very nervous and anxious, but they still get up and do it on stage. So it wasn't that unusual. I suppose for me, I just thought it was normal that, you know, everyone's inner voice was particularly critical. I think if there was one word I could cut out of our vocabulary, either internally or externally, is should. And, you know, I was definitely suffering from something which I call a terrible dose of the shoulds. Mm. And a lot of us do, you know, whether, you know, whatever you're thinking about, maybe I should be stronger, I should be thinner, I should have gone to bed earlier, I should have gotten up earlier, I should see my friends more. And sometimes that should voice can just go on loop in our minds and can be constantly putting us under pressure to be more. I should be more at this stage in my life. So
yeah,
I guess I was experiencing that. And I think a lot of people have that inner dialogue running.
Were you a pretty intense person to be around at this point?
I don't think so. You know, I suppose I've always been an extrovert. You know, people would have seen me as an extrovert and all that. But I think I was very tired, you know, and I didn't realize that I was just exhausted. And sleep is a big thing for people. And it's certain once your sleep, if you're not getting enough or your sleep is out of whack, it can start to snowball then, because your ability to recover from stressful situations is diminished. And I think that's what I was struggling with a lot.
And then meditation came into your life. I suppose what a lot of people would think is, yeah, I'm not the type really for it. I presume you weren't the type for meditation either.
Not at all. I thought that meditation was for Californian types who just ate hummus with everything and, you know, dressed in long, flowy yoga clothes and had beads instead of doors and were constantly talking about their chakras. Yeah, I couldn't relate to it at all initially. But I knew that I needed to try something else, because clearly what I was doing wasn't working. And quite by chance, I met a lovely woman called Siobhan McKenna, who was launching her book. And she asked me to MC her book launch. And I found out that she was a meditation teacher in her spare time and that she had been teaching the guards. And I thought, well, if it works for law enforcement, then possibly it could work for me. So we did a swap and she gave me a lesson. And I've been meditating pretty much for well over 10 years, and I've been a teacher for about 3.
And listen, you make a very good case for it in your book, and you enumerate the benefits of it. But just like, it almost sounds like a superpower in some ways. Just enumerate there what it did for you.
Well, I suppose what was happening to me, and I was unaware, and it happens to a lot of people, is that our stress response can be active a lot, if not all, of the time. So we've all heard of fight or flight. And that's our inner alarm. If you imagine it like a smoke alarm, that's just ringing. And it's a very helpful tool when we're under pressure for short periods of time because it helps us to perform at our best. But the issue is for so many of us, and particularly since the pandemic started, is that this internal smoke alarm or alarm or barking dog is going off all the time. And we all know, you know, if ever our neighbors have gone on holidays and their house alarm is ringing nonstop, it can be very wearing and it can be very exhausting. So for me, what was happening was I was just in fight or flight and running on adrenaline and cortisol the whole time. And that was stopping me from sleeping properly and just keeping me in that emergency state. So once I learned a couple of simple techniques to just turn off that inner alarm long enough for my body to come back online and my nervous system to calm down, then it had a massive ripple effect out into everything else in my day. So, you know, in scientific terms, we're actually allowing other parts of our brain to come back online. So those parts that are responsible for self-awareness, our empathy, our kindness to ourselves and others, our ability to think and make better decisions in the moment, all those are activated when we can just take enough of a break. And it could be just literally a breath or two to just turn off that inner smoke alarm that's ringing nonstop.
And listen, there is one very simple one that you have in the book that I thought was really good. We won't actually do it now because I think it might be a bit weird for people if we're just breathing. But the 4:10, which anyone could do in about 1 minute, is just basically talk us through it there. You tell us it in 10 seconds, like.
Yeah, well, we could do that. I do know, I do one called a one breath wonder. Would you like to try a one breath meditation? And this will do everything that I've said in terms of it will lower your heart rate, lower your blood pressure, lower your stress hormone levels. And that is literally one breath.
Okay.
We could do that.
Okay, let's
okay?
go.
So anyone listening can do it as well. So if you take a nice, long, slow, deep breath in through your nose and imagine you're breathing down into your belly. Hold it in your belly for a moment and then just be aware of your breath leaving your body. Just listen to the sound of it leaving. Feel your belly dropping back down again and feel the breath go out. Now, congratulations, you're all meditators.
Bang, that's it, right.
That is a one-breath wonder. So what we did there, it may seem a bit, you know, silly or easy, but actually what you did in that moment was you were focusing your attention on your breath, which meant you were in that famous present moment, which sounds very Oprah, but there's a lot of sense to it. Because when you're in that present moment and you're focusing on your breath, even for those couple of seconds, you're not in the past worrying about stuff that you did or that people did to you, and you're not in the future worrying about stuff that might happen in the future. You were just there, and it's impossible to be anxious if you're in that present moment.
Yeah. There's a great line in, I don't know if you've seen that movie, The Sound of Metal. The guy in it's a former addict, but there's a great line where he says to his sponsor at one point, so you told me serenity is when I can stop wishing I had a different past. But it's kind of similar to that, isn't it? Just past is a done deal. It's sunk cost, isn't it? So listen, I suppose the point people might get from that there, and it is very much, I think, in line with your philosophy of how you teach, is that, as you say, you don't need to be in an ashram in California to meditate, that it's something that anyone can do and people can do it to whatever level they want to as well and whatever time they have.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and people are time poor these days. They've a lot going on. And I think the biggest misconception around it is that you have to be able to clear your mind. And I think that puts a lot of people off. And they think, look, that may be great for your man with a shaved head who's banging a drum, you know, walking down Patrick Street in Cork. But actually, for me, you know, I'm not like that. But we have 80,000 thoughts a day going through our minds. They're not going anywhere. And in fact, we don't want them to because they're literally keeping us alive. Mm. So all we're doing is focusing our mind on one thing. And when your mind wanders off, which it absolutely will, you just go, oh, my mind has wandered, and you gently bring it back to your breath. And that's it. So meditation is not about clearing your mind. It's a tennis match. And, you know, it's a tennis match between attention and distraction. Attention and distraction. And, you know, if your mind wanders a lot when you try it, it doesn't mean that your brain is broken or that you're doing it wrong. That's exactly what minds do. That's what thoughts do. They bounce around. But the more we do it, the more we train it, and we get out of that anxious state. I mean, science shows us that. I love talking about the science, you know, because there's so much of it, particularly in the last 10 years or so. You know, there's a Harvard study from 2012 which shows that, you know, even beginner meditators, after 8 weeks of meditating, their amygdala, the part of the brain that makes us freak out and shout at a cyclist or, you know, get really nervous when we read a news article, that part of our brain actually shrinks in size. You know, even in beginner meditators, they scanned their brains and they found that their fear center had shrunk. And conversely, other parts of their brain, even in these beginners that responsible for self-awareness and logical thinking and memory function, that had actually grown. There was more gray matter. So it will physically change the shape of your brain, and you don't have to blow up your job or move to India or walk the Camino or start wearing socks with sandals. You know, or start putting up selfies on Instagram of you meditating on a cliff top. You don't have to do any of that.
Yeah, okay. Listen, in tandem with this, and like, as you said earlier, you weren't drinking more than anyone else did, and the people around you and stuff, but you did find that you largely gave up drink. And like, I have to say, in the book, you make quite a good case for it. Like, I was nearly reading it and thinking, yeah, maybe he's got a point. Like, what's the point of drinking?
Yeah, I mean, I did make an effort. I knew that I became aware that I was using it to just sort of as an anesthetic. And I think a lot of us do. And a lot of it is just habit as well. You know, we get to Friday and we're like, let's crack open a bottle of wine. And it's sort of, this is great. But, you know, I felt that it was acting as an amplifier for the part of me that was beating myself up. So that, you know, in the book, I call it the nun on the end of the bread and nun on the end of the bed. And it was a sort of a personification of this inner critical voice. And I realized that after I drank alcohol the next day or for the following few days, I would be beating myself up more. So it was like I turned the volume up on that critical inner voice. And I noticed that when I stopped for a year completely, I actually got rid of that haze that alcohol can put over us sometimes. And I was actually able to see the things that were maybe not that helpful for me in my mind a little bit clearer.
Okay. Listen, thanks a million for that, Dermot. And the book is called Mindful, Unwreck Your Head, De-stress Your Life by Dermot Whelan. And it's out now. Text here at Dermot says, Dermot is describing me. Fair play to him. I'm really delighted to hear him talking about this. I'm still struggling with it, but love hearing that it's not just me. And that's from Dave. So wasn't that nice of your on-air partner, Dave, obviously, sending a supportive text? Listen, there's just one thing there. A texter here saying, where do you start re-meditation, Brendan, i.e. classes online or what? I know what your answer to this is going to be, Dermot.
There's a great book. It's by Dermot Whelan. It's called Mindful. And, okay. You know, in there I have meditations. You know, you get access to my website, which is dermotwhelan.com. And there's lots of free guided meditations up there as well that people can start with.
Yeah, and there is good, very basic starter stuff there. All right, listen, absolutely. Dermot Whelan, thanks a million. Let's take a break.
Text 51551. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.